sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The worst day for equities in months. January set for a lower close. Emerging markets are taking a beating, and we have a good friend and a great guest, Larry Williams, with us here today. All this and much more on episode number 348 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, good morning, good evening. How are you? And this is Andrew Horowitz. I got to apologize. Sorry about last week. Just couldn't do it. Couldn't put it together. Time in January seems to be slipping by very quickly, and I just couldn't get the time to do a podcast. And I figured, you know what? Instead of putting together a shorty that was going to be, you know, just full of basic information, I thought, you know what? Let's just wait a week, take a little rest. Haven't missed a podcast in many, many months, if not years. So my apologies for those of you who are waiting and wondering what is going on. I did get a lot of emails. Answer them as I always do. You can just email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com at any time, and I'll do my best to answer them. But I, like I said, it's been a crazy January. I don't know how you feel, but I've been talking to a lot of people, and January has been just absolutely, it seems to be compressed in terms of time, maybe because of the way the holidays played out, or maybe because of just the amount of work that's out there. But a lot of people are saying the same thing, that, man, January has been just crazy in terms of busy. So lots of things going on. It is an unusual January in that oftentimes January does have a nice lift to it due to the January effect, where there's a small cap bias to the upside. And in fact, you do see that due to the fact that many players out there are looking to buy back after the 30-day wash rule stocks they sold last year, maybe for tax purposes or possibly for other reasons. They're able to do it now. And what happened is very much the opposite. It seems that January came around and all of a sudden the sentiment changed. It's almost like a reverse of what happened in 2013. If you recall, in 2013, the end of the year prior kind of fizzled out a bit, and January came and the first came and it was off to the races. Where in 2014, we're seeing pretty much the opposite. There's a lot of people saying, hey, you know what? Maybe I'm going to take some money off the table here. Maybe they're thinking that, you know, the old adage and the adage that you need to always remember is don't fight the Fed. Of course, don't fight the tape, but don't fight the Fed is in play because they're talking about tapering, and they did, in fact, begin the process of reducing down their bond purchases. Well, maybe that is having some effect on things, even though we did see that yields did come down pretty well in the last week or so. The fact is that there's a lot of selling going on. The discussion about why the selling really plowed higher on Thursday and Friday of last week has been that the emerging markets are having a lot of trouble. In particular, there's been an enormous swing in currencies. You look at Turkey, you look at Argentina, their currencies have been just obliterated in the last week or so. And the reason for that is being blamed on the fact that the tapering that has been going on is lifting the value of the dollar as compared to those currencies. And we all knew that one of the places that was going to be in trouble if we did see a very significant reduction in the amount of stimulus in the U.S. was going to be the emerging markets. There's a lot of reasons for that. One we just mentioned was currency. You know, you may see that there's going to be a rise in the dollar, and then currencies in those countries would be problematic, and they do affect their markets. Sometimes when sentiment is really good, a lower currency is very beneficial. But remember, things change, things cycle. And when you see that currencies are moving lower, it does also mean a weakening situation, particularly in Turkey. Now, the other thing that could be in play here is the idea that you see a little bit of a slowdown in the economics and housing, and leading indicators lagged a bit. And we did see that the employment numbers are sticking over 300,000. And a lot of people came to the belief that the 6.7% unemployment rate that we saw, even though it seems good on the outside, the internal numbers of new hires was really not that good. And everybody knows, it's well known by now, that the unemployment number is really a result of a much lower amount of employees in the workforce, or people that are in the workforce at this point. There's also been a lot of discussion about the whole idea that maybe, just maybe, it is a structural situation right now that is really causing the unemployment rate to be higher than anticipated. This is something that we talked about for a long time. Remember the idea that technology has been taking over many jobs, and that there are positions that are no longer viable and no longer able to be filled because they're just not there anymore. So I'm not going to bore you to death with that whole concept that we've been talking about for a very long time, but it seems that now there's been a lot more discussion, a lot more play, a lot more interest in this idea. And I think that this is really going to start resounding and being written about very much more than we saw in the past. So we have the emerging markets that really saw some trouble, with the potential for bankruptcies in Turkey. Now, you have to remember that Turkey, they're a very proud country. I want to read you a couple of things that I found. After the recent drop in their currency and all the things that went on in Turkey, over the weekend there was a commentary by the economic minister in Turkey saying that it's absolutely impossible to have an economic crisis in Turkey. So he's in Davos and he says, Turkey won't have a crisis and can't. Think about a body that's super healthy. Its brain is healthy. Its ears are healthy. Its lungs are like fans. Its liver is magnificent. There's no problem anywhere in the body, but it catches a flu. He says, be sure of Turkey. Trust in Turkey. There's something I've said in a few places. It's impossible to bring about a crisis in Turkey. You can't. The central bank has enough stock in its hands now to give anyone who wants their money and send them home. It gave currency to foreign currency to everyone who wanted it, and it can give as much as it wants. Now, there's a corruption investigation there that is going on, and this economic minister says that it's meant to embarrass them before all the international banks and financial institutions and blacken their lives. You know who these people are? They're those who are building the third bridge, the third airport, nuclear power stations, the ones building the world's biggest bridge over the Marmara and the Izmir Highway. It's a team to stop Turkey's biggest projects. Just like they want to stop in May, they've intervened directly now. And he goes on and on and on and talks about how, you know, it's really impossible. And this is just a giant mechanism that's being done by outsiders to defame and to really make Turkey look bad because they want the business and it's all... I got to tell you something. This is spooky. You know, you talk about confidence, where he says it's impossible to bring a crisis in Turkey. You can't do it, he says. I mean, that is some set of balls. And those are fighting words when it comes to markets. You know, markets will always test. They're always going to test how far they can push. And these kind of statements are, I find, to be very much a very bad way for a central banker or a finance minister to actually greet their investors and the public. This is why we're seeing the problem. Because if you can't bring about a crisis in Turkey, and the idea is that, you know, they'll always be there, think about how much you could really press on the pedal on either side of the equation, whether it's long or short, whether it's currency, whether it's stocks. I mean, you really could do some damage here, and they will, just to prove this guy wrong. And I don't think I've ever seen these kind of words of confidence spoken by any other finance minister, to a point that they're saying that it's impossible to bring around any kind of financial crisis. And again, this is some of the reasons why there is a lot of volatility going on right now, particularly in Turkey. You know, speaking about the idea of markets testing, we have Janet Yellen that will be very soon the head of the Fed. And I shall tell you that I believe that the same thing is going to happen in terms of testing the Fed. One of the great things that Bernanke did for himself and the Fed was to start the tapering and the withdrawal of bond purchases prior to him leaving. Now, why that's so great is that he basically hooked himself up with book deals, speeches, and all sorts of other greatness opportunities in the future, because no matter what happens now, he can't say that he didn't stop the potential for runaway inflation if that occurs. In other words, instead of just leaving things as they were and letting Janet Yellen and the Fed that comes after and the new Fed decide on when the tapering is going to happen, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, what he did was start it so that he could effectively say in the future that, hey, you know what? I was all in favor of slowing it down. And, you know, I don't know what happened after I left, but basically, you know, my intent, my vote was all for making sure that we didn't have too much stimulus in the economy, and on and on and on. Now he put the onus on the next group of Fed and Janet Yellen. And if we do have an inflationary environment, or in fact we need to pump more stimulus into the economy, it's all up to them. And Bernanke is credited with reviving the economy, doing all sorts of unorthodox types of maneuvers with Fed policy to make sure that the housing market came back, that the bank failures didn't get out of control, that the stock market and the wealth effect was there. So kudos to Bernanke. And that will remain as a historical point that no matter what he does right now, he won. He was victorious. He will always go down in history of as the man who headed the Fed who stopped a depression from going and every bank from failing and the entire breakdown of the financial system in the U.S. Now, one of the things that we're also seeing is that there's already a discussion that they're going to potentially look at reducing down the unemployment rate target, which is now 6.5%, the target by the Fed of when they're going to start slowing down or removing stimulus. And they may take it down to 6%. In addition, they're probably going to do something about the inflation target, which is 2%. Right now, the 2%, it's not there yet, but at the same time, it's really not that far away if we do see an uptick. In fact, Ken Rogoff, he was talking this weekend, he talked about the fact that he believes that the Fed was too shy and too conservative regarding inflation right from the start. And if they don't raise their upper limit for inflation, the positive trend of the rest of global economies movement and growth could derail if long-term interest rates rise too quickly. And he also believes that at the same time, this I thought was really interesting, talked about the European zone. You know, the Eurozone has been just an absolute mystery. We know that the banking system is still not healed. We know that there's still a ridiculous level of unemployment. You know, Spain is at 25%. Overall is 12.5% or 13% in the Eurozone. We know that there's still a lot of problems with Greece and the ancillary countries that we know about. Germany has said that they're not giving any more money starting 2015 to any kind of debt relief. Rogoff says Eurozone is not even close to recovery. He says the growth in the periphery will barely be positive as long as there's bank debt, private and public debt. And without debt haircuts, the recovery phase will take decades. Now, we know one of the things that Europe has been really against is haircuts, because the idea of a haircut on a bond that would, in fact, be laid out against not only investors, but the ECB and the various funds that are backing the banks would be problematic. They have been in a they've had very thin margin for error. Now, so far, investor confidence has been holding up. In fact, Europe has been the bright spot in 2014 in terms of returns on equities. Most of the world is down, and most of Europe is still up for the year. They're up maybe 1 or 2, maybe even 3%, depending on the country. And at the same time, it's kind of funny that we see that the euro is at pretty high levels compared to where possibly it should be valued when it comes to the output and the economic stability and strength of the underlying countries that make it up. And at the same time, the fact is that everybody does know that there still is a lot of holes in the fabric of their financial system. How long Draghi is going to actually be able to put off the inevitable, which is haircuts and a change to the banking system's overall debt structure and debt that they have outstanding is a mystery. But so far it's working, and that will work. All these things will work during high sentiment. It's like high tide. We always talk about this kind of thing. You know, when it's high tide, you don't see the rubble and the garbage and the clams and the shells and the bottom of the ocean. But when that tide goes out, just like when sentiment changes, what happens? You see every bit of garbage that's there, and it really shows up very clearly. And that's when problems start, because all of a sudden there's nothing covering it up. There's nothing that is creating any kind of distortion to the view. And you see what's actually there. When you have that high level of sentiment that we've had for some time, where people are being pushed into various instruments and looking for yield, it all disappears. But when that does stop and there's all of a sudden a collective consciousness that starts to say, hey, you know what? Let's take a look at some of this. That's when things are problematic. And that seems to be what's creeping into the markets right now. There have been some great earnings that we've seen, like a Netflix. Even Microsoft came out with good earnings. A lot of companies in the tech area and in the consumer, we'll call it technology area, have done well. The banks have done okay. You know, we've seen that they're continuing to show better than expected results, and some of the revenue is better. We're still seeing, again, revenue slowdowns and revenue meets or just a bit misses when EPS is beaten by 1 or 2 cents. But overall, like we saw last quarter, really nothing to stand up and cheer about in terms of the earnings of the S&P or overall stocks this quarter so far. It's still early in the game, but yet there's really not a lot that could be said to be very exciting. Again, there's some that are good, but at the same time, do those levels that we're seeing right now, even though they meet up with the actual valuations that should be put on many of the stocks that are showing these earnings? And I think that we're starting to see that the answer may be not really. And it's the same discussion. It's all about sentiment. The better the sentiment, the better you'll see P.E. ratios and expansion of P.E. ratios. The better the sentiment, the less likely a miss will be just, you know, blown out. Look at KSU last week, you know, the train and transportation company. I mean, it was down like 15% on an earnings miss. It started out the day down 19%. That's a big number for a blue chip, for a transportation company. We'll talk some more about this in a moment. I also want to talk to you about a new strategy called Arrow. You need to hear about this. But before we do that, we're going to talk with Larry Williams. I've been trying to get him on for a while, and I'm very glad that he's able to do so today. And going to ask him some good things about, you know, not only the idea of what's going on in the world of futures and trading and all that, but, you know, what's his opinions of markets, etc. So Larry Williams, I Really Trade, a master trader, educator, all-around nice guy, also has some great applications available for some of his systems over at TradeStation and other places, and like I said, just a great educator. Larry, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you very much, Andrew, for having me here in such a flowery words. I like to hear that. I wish my wife would have heard that.
Yeah, well, good luck. So listen, one of the things I want to talk to you about was, there's a lot of things, but, you know, a few years ago we started talking about this whole yield curve and the relationship to the S&P 500 and the predictions you can make on that. And, you know, you've been using that since what, the 1970s?
That's correct. I wrote about the indicator in my first book back in the 1970s. And, you know, it's done a pretty good job of telling us in advance when the important rallies and declines in the stock market will take place.
So when you do this, it has a bit of a, there's a lagging portion, and there's also a kind of, you can see into the future a bit with this by utilizing the calculation you do. So the suggestion of where we ended, let's say, in 2013 and moving forward through 2014, what is that that model and your cycle saying?
Well, some strength at the very first of January, but then starting around the middle of January, somewhere past the midpoint of January, we go down, it gets ugly, and we go down for a while, then we're going to start to come back up, and then it gets real ugly later on in 2014.
It's been pretty interesting how the, I think that the cycle of sentiment has changed or has, you know, gone back to, I guess, normality, where we have these really high levels of frustration, fear, and just overall disgust. And then that somehow all of a sudden turns into, hey, the stock market's never going down, and you know I love it, and I'm putting all my extra money and every nickel that I can find into the stock market. And then in between there is the quiet period, right? So we're back to what? Close to the right side of that where you know everybody wants to buy stocks again.
Well, everybody has been excessively bullish in here. And the problem with that is that usually tops markets, but not always, because in a big uptrend, everybody's bullish all the way along.
Right.
They're bullish in the middle and they're bullish at the end. So there's a bit of a problem in that, but kind of an interesting analogy you pointed out. You know, you look at the Super Bowl teams, only two teams are in the Super Bowl. The teams that lost won't be in the Super Bowl. Their fans are saying, next year we're going to come back. But in the market, the cycle is, oh, we're never going to come back. I've never coming back to the stock market.
Right.
And then the market takes off again. There was, oh, that's my team.
Right.
I'm a Dow Jones guy now. But they lose faith in their team at bear market bottoms.
So essentially what you're saying is that investors are like Dolphins fans.
Yeah, they're like Dolphins fans. They gave up the ghost. When Don Tula left, goodbye.
That's it. We don't care about them unless they win, and otherwise we're not buying tickets.
That, yeah. Well, and you know, that is true. I mean, that's life in general. Everybody wants to be a winner. I never will forget. I walked into the Joe Frazier Muhammad Ali fight in Madison Square Gardens, and everybody's going crazy over Ali, and they're chanting Ali, Ali. And about the fourth round, Joe Frazier knocks Ali down, and everybody starts going, "Go Joe, go Joe!" Yeah. A minute ago, they were Ali fans.
Right, right, right. Like,
talk about a switch in public opinion.
Yeah, it's so interesting
people
because
do like a winner.
Well, you know, the thought has been that the Fed and the various powers have been pushing people into different investments. I mean, you look at what you can get on cash, which is nothing, or even short-term debt instruments, which is, you know, nothing plus a little bit more. And, you know, there really aren't a lot of choices out there. And people are saying, you know what, at least I can get 2% on a dividend yield on a stock. And not somehow not realizing and remembering that, you know, that 2% that you can get on an annual basis can disappear in a day. And that's
And it's just, I think you need to have perspective if you're going to be a successful investor. You know that from managing money, that you need a perspective of where we are, where we're going. And there are certainly highs and lows of when there's too many people or yields are too low or they're too high. And there are boundaries to the market.
So when it comes to the idea of what makes a winning investor, successful investor, and in your years of teaching and viewing and observing and seeing both sides of the spectrum, what is it really the characteristics that, you know, to make somebody a successful investor, they have to really, you know, have in well, they don't have to own it to begin with, but that they have to learn and then live by?
Well, you know, my son's a psychiatrist trained at Johns Hopkins, and Jason did a McGraw-Hill book called the Mental Edge in Trading, where he researched just successful traders to get an answer to that question. And the answer really is all of these highly successful traders and investors all had to find their trading strategy that fit their personality. In other words, you're not trading or investing in the market. You're really trading or investing in your personality. Mm. You really have to understand your emotions and how you think, and then find that strategy for the marketplace. Every one of these guys, billionaire guys, right, or highly successful traders like myself, everybody had arrived at their strategy. That was the number one thing we found in all of these people.
So if you're like most of us, and what happens is you come into the day and you're charged up for breakfast, and then you're kind of, if you eat the wrong things and all that, you kind of get a little bit of a drama and you get back up at noon, and then towards the end of the day, dinner. It's kind of like what the market does. You know, it kind of spikes or does whatever it does in the morning, lays off a little bit, comes back after lunch, and then it lays off a little bit, and then it closes somewhere moving again.
It's like, and, it's just like the freeway system is jammed in the morning, then it's quiet, and it's jammed on the way home. Well, that's the market, isn't it?
You know, I've always wondered something. You could drive down the road, and if everybody's doing the same speed, generally speaking, it's I don't care how many cars are there, you could really, cruise along pretty well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who was that first person that put the brakes on?
I know.
Screwed the whole thing up every morning for everybody.
I know. Where is that guy? I'd love to fly over, and I'm flying into cities. I look for that guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to make the plane do a cleanse of the laboratories at that point in time. In terms of the market, so you do a lot of futures trading. I know that, and a lot of work in that area. What is the areas that you're really focusing in? I know you do the ES and all that. Do you do any of the foods and the
last year we called for a big bull market in soybean meal. We got that. I think this year, the first part of the year, the heating oil market is so strong here, in part because of the weather, natural gas as well. You look at your chart, you'll see heating oil has been much stronger than crude oil. Strong seasonal tendency for the crude oil to start to rally in February. It's already begun that rally. Any pullback in February, that's a buying opportunity.
And the seasonality you're talking about is in advance of the summer.
Well, yeah, it looks like in very cold winters that crude oil, heating oil, because that's what we're heating our homes with in cold weather, though not here in the Virgin Islands where nobody even owns a heater, that's when prices really start to escalate. So people start to panic. That's usually the coldest part of the year, the first couple of weeks in February. And so it's been a really sweet spot to buy if heating oil has been in an uptrend and it's been doing well in here. So I think there's a play coming up here in the heating oil market.
Now, in terms of going back to the foods for a second, do you have to look at all of the various crop reports, or you just play it by the actual trend in the charts and various indicators, or how do you balance both?
Well, I try to balance both. I mean, to me, the most important thing in the grain markets is looking at the spreads. Last year, we saw that the nearby contracts were selling for a premium over the distance. As you know, that's very bullish. Doesn't happen often. So that tells us that the commercials, the users and producers want the commodity desperately. They're paying a premium for it. So I'll look at that. I certainly look at the commitment of trader report, started doing that in 1973. These are the biggest guys in the marketplace. Again, the users and producers, if they're heavily long, the market's probably going to rally. So I like to look at the guys who know more than I know to see where they're actually laying down their hard-earned money. Yeah. And then I try to emulate that viewpoint.
Just as a point of reference, one of the things that Larry and I share together is that we both do some work over at and use TradeStation as well. And one of the things that you mentioned right now was that the commitment to traders report, because that you can actually get that from the futures traders
from the CFTC.
Yeah, you can get that from them, and it's a snapshot or whatever. But if you want to see a little bit more graphical representation of it, right, you have to kind of look at the history and see where they are, because it's a snapshot, doesn't tell you much. And then it shows you the various, I guess it's really three core holders and players, right? You have the others, which are maybe the retail and things like that, and you got the
small
commercial
speculators.
Yeah, small
guys.
You got the hedgers, the big industrial guys, or maybe the chicken farmers and all those guys, or maybe even the farmers, and then you got kind of the hedge funds and the guys in the middle, right?
And you have to understand that there are different purposes. The trader, the small guys, are trying to make a buck in the markets, catching short-term highs and lows. The large traders are now funds, not people like myself anymore, but commodity funds. They're trend players. They drive the momentum of the market. And then you have the commercials, and that's totally different. You have to understand these guys. If sugar goes down, they're going to buy it all the way down,
right?
Because they're not speculating in the market. They're buying sugar to make candy bars and cakes out of.
Right. And I mentioned like the chicken guys and the turkey guys and the producers of, we'll call it, any kind of livestock or any kind of product. I mean, you don't have a choice. You're buying your cornmeal, your soy, whatever you're buying, in particular animal, you're buying it. And in fact, it's different than trading a trend where you're looking maybe for a breakout or looking for a move over something. The bottom line is that with this, you're looking for, the opportunity to get it cheaper, right?
Absolutely. So if you're raising, you're fattening cattle and corn prices are lower and they go lower, you will buy more. So it's typical to see the commercials buy all the way down. You have to understand the relationship of price to commercial activity. People have looked at commercials, a light bulb switches on, it's off. Wrong, wrong, wrong. You have to put it into perspective of what price is doing. Then it's a very valuable tool.
Right, exactly. So the reason why I mentioned it is because it's kind of like an inside trade station you can customize it, but there's a basic commitment of traders run that you have. Now, these are usually out on Friday afternoons, right, for the previous week?
Yeah, it comes out, it's actually the date is through Tuesday, and then it comes out Friday night.
Right.
And it used to be in the old days, we got it 2 months late. It was mailed on a monthly basis and was mailed to us, so we got it really late.
What did you do with that? What could you do with that?
Well, again, it's perspective.
I gotcha.
Because it's not a timing tool. People are looking for this to be a timing tool. It's a setup tool.
Right.
And we've taken it a step farther, and I've figured out how these guys, when they buy and sell. So I have my surrogate index. It's almost an exact match of what the commercials are doing. So I can see on a daily basis if the commercials most likely are buying or selling and what their net position is going to be at the end of the week. So we have a heads up on it. And then when the government was shut down in October, our numbers match their numbers. When their numbers finally came out.
You know, in terms of, you know, the commitments of traders, you know what I like to see? I like to see when I see the news headlines, like on a Bloomberg or something, that says that that hedge funds are the most bullish they've been in, you know, X amount of time, but a long time, like let's say a year, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. the most bearish they are in about a year, or they have more contracts than, you know, the last 2 years. I love to go the contrary trade on that.
Well, yeah, whenever anybody is an extreme, but I'll tell you what really makes it more important, Andrew, if you look at open interest, if open interest is excessively high and you have a large net reading by the long traders, not the commercials, but the large traders, then that's very bearish. So again, I like to put this into perspective of who owns that open interest. Low levels of open interest can be very bearish if it's not owned by the commercials.
And you don't use that as much, obviously, for things like financial markets, do you? You do, really?
Yeah. Now, most people don't use the commercials correctly in the financial markets and the stock indexes because they don't realize, again, they want to make it black and white and simple. But we have so much arbitrage going on now. People have been buying the S&P here and selling the Turkish stock exchange because it's been the weakest one. So they're not really bullish on America. They're bearish on they want to spread off the bet.
Right.
Or they're buying the DAX because that's been the strongest and selling the E-minis. So you really have to look at some relationships, but it can be a very, very good tool. You just, again, it's all about understanding the data, who's behind the data. It isn't just, you know, it's above a line, it's below a line. You need to put it in the correct perspective and the correct time periods.
So how does somebody find out? Seriously, how does somebody learn? You know, obviously you teach this, but what's the educational process to learn more about, you know, really understanding of some of these things, because you're mentioning a lot of different things and you know, just looking and understanding the commitments of traders report with some of their language in there is a little bit tough. You know, how does somebody learn what are the important things? It's kind of like stocks, right? You need to know, all right, what are the fundamentals? Well, you can't just look at PE. You got to look at that in perspective, PE to G or something. How does somebody really learn about that?
Well, I learned from a guy who had been a member of the Board of Trade, Bill Meehan, way back in the 1970s. And Bill had so many nuances that he had learned. And I guess I've passed that on to my students. There's not a lot of people that really get into it anymore because everybody's computerized and they don't want to think about, well, what does this mean? But some of the old traders that still do this stuff, and you know, we talk and it's interesting. We don't talk about pennants and Fibonacci numbers and stuff. We're talking about contangos and premiums and spreads. It's like a totally different conversation
than
when I start talking with the traditional a guy with a trade station or a chart.
So is it my understanding, am I correct in saying that anybody that takes your course, you fly down to the Virgin Islands?
No, we haven't done that, but I bet we could sell a lot more if we did.
I think I have to do a due diligence on you, Larry.
You should definitely do that. You'd love to come down here. We do bring about 50 traders down here every year and do some intensive short-term trading seminars for a week. And people from all over the world come, and they love it when they get here.
I'm sure.
Them a great time, of course. But, yeah, people love St. Croix.
I love it. It's fantastic. All right, so in terms of we talked about the trend a little bit. We talked about short-term and the longer-term mm-hmm. trend going on right now. We talked about some of the, you know, trading and all this. Now, when it comes to, you know, the idea of executing and then owning a position, and then the thing that's really important is the idea of two things, money management and setting appropriate expectations and stops, right? So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think money management, truthfully, has been misconstrued. It's really emotional management. Some people, if they lose $1,000, they'll flip out. Somebody else, it doesn't bother at all. So your emotions, in other words, your ability to make rational decisions, are really contingent not on just the market, but on if your bet size is too big for your emotions. So that's really important. Once you establish that, then you're not as emotional. You can make better decisions in the marketplace. So I then need to know how I'm going to, you know, enter and where am I going to acknowledge a defeat. Mm-hmm. I like trend lines. I like to see the market moving in my favor. And if I see significant points taken out of the marketplace or I've lost X percent, I'm out. I'm out. Maybe the market will come back. Usually it doesn't, been my experience. I don't mind getting stopped out because most all of the times when I'm stopped out, the markets continue going down. If mm-hmm. you're getting stopped out a lot, it's just because your stops are way too close to the market.
You know, I've seen that actually. You know, it's interesting. You know, where we sometimes will put a stop, I've noticed that, yes, you know, one day is one thing. I'm talking, but, you know, it's funny because it's almost like those stop levels are that most people would use are known by the players out there. And what they do is they utilize that to your disadvantage. You know, what they do is they go out and they'll, you know, figure on, let's blow that stop level that looks like a stop level, bring it down a little bit from there, and then just run it back up. So this way they could take it down pretty well and buy it on the significant shove down during, of a particular level. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen it. But if that happens, your stop is too close to that.
Right. So what time frames do you work on? I mean, do you work on daily? You working on weekly? You working on 50 minutes?
Daily and weekly. I do very little interday. You know, there's so much static in there. Just daily and weekly charts.
Yeah, that's the best. I mean, for swing trading, et cetera. I mean, you know, I've had people who, called and I talked to and they're like, oh, yeah, I love this indicator on like, you know, a tick chart. I'm like, a tick chart? How can you possibly do anything with a tick chart?
Yeah, that's not where the big money is.
No, you know, you're trying to what, scalp? I don't even know what you're trying to scalp. Even for that matter, going on a, you know, a 1 minute or a 5 minute chart. I mean, I could see how utilizing a 30 maybe or 60 minute chart to kind of get an idea of the trend, you know, as it progresses, you know, progressively moves in a direction and maybe starts moving. And then you start, okay, fine, we'll go to a 240 chart and then maybe we'll look at a daily. But, you know, less than that, I think it's people doing a real disservice to themselves.
I agree, and that means you also have to watch the market every minute, every right. single minute of the day. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I hear you. So Larry's over at I Really Trade, and he also has some great indicators over on the TradeStation app store that you can buy. If anybody has TradeStation, as we talk about, sponsor of this podcast today, you know, I think that you'll really like what you see there. And plus, I think that you're also doing some training over there, aren't you?
A little bit, yeah. Yep. We have a lot of webinars, and people learn a lot about the TradeStation. There's some stuff on YouTube as well.
Yeah, so you can check. I mean, just look up Larry Williams, and then after that put, you know, Brilliant Handsome Trader. Right after that, Brilliant Handsome
there
Trader.
You
don't want to get the wrong guy. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So you put, you know, look up Larry Williams and check it out. Of course, you can go to ireallytrade.com and find out more information on his courses and the things that he offers as well. And this is a guy, how many books have you written?
Eight, maybe.
Yeah, so you on another one? You're writing another one?
No.
Done. I may have capped it at two.
Yeah, too much arthritis in my fingers.
Too much arthritis in my brain. But hey, listen, Larry, thanks so much. I know you got to go. Listen, great talking to you. Speak to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Andrew. Enjoyed being with you. Look forward to it again. Thanks much.
There you have it, right from the horse's mouth. Larry Williams, great guy. Got to pick up his books and follow him. He's got some great things to share. I got to tell you something, especially if you're trying to learn about how to trade futures and understand the futures markets and the economic or the market cycles, I should say, not economic, but market cycles. He's the best at it. All right, so what else do we have to talk about here? I want to talk about a few different things regarding this Arrow strategy. You know, we've been working on something for months, and we basically were working on a strategy that was purely a technical strategy. A strategy that we built with approximately 10 different proprietary and some traditional oscillating and trending indicators. And essentially what we did was created a method to target those times that we're seeing extreme high points, extreme low points with the S&P 500. And on top of that, looking for the optimum time to move in or move out of a position, both long and short, okay? So what we did was we did a lot of work to identify this and to come up with a process that could actually do this on a very intelligent level. And we went back 20 years, and the testing was really accurate in this situation because we did it in a way that wasn't relying on outside influences, intraday market moves, and anything that may affect a traditional back test, Because when you do a back test, you usually want to make sure that you have the ability to actually execute. And when you don't execute at the price you want, for example, if it maybe hits something, you have slippage. And a lot of times the slippage, which is the differential between the signal and the actual initiation, is large. But we wanted to do this in a way that we didn't have that problem. So we looked at, okay, fine, how do we do that? And we came up with, we get the signal the night before, and you execute on the open the next day. And that left a lot of the question marks out. You didn't have any of those problems with this. Well, what's really interesting is if you look at the actual performance over the last about 20 years, since 1995, so about 19 years, through the current end of last year, so that would be December of 2013. If you take the SPY, both long and short, and you look at that, it's up about 450% or so, while this strategy is up about 2,500%. That's net of all fees, commissions, costs, et cetera, and slippage, by the way. We put in a chunk of slippage in there. And this, it goes long and short. And essentially what happens is that it gives a signal. Now, it doesn't give a signal every single day. It sometimes will be in a position for a long time. In fact, if you look recently, the last long signal was August, and the strategy was actually in a long position from August through last Thursday was the signal to sell the long and to get short, and you got short Friday morning on the open. So you sold a position that you made a nice run up since August, and you actually went short. And the potential is that that short could last a very short period of time, because if it comes down very fast or moves up very fast, you get a quick signal one direction, and then it may reverse. Now, there's been times where you see maybe a signal that happens, once a day for, 3 or 4 days, and then nothing for a while. Here's a couple of stats I want you to pay attention to. Number one, 92% of the time it's been in a position since the last 19 or so years, okay? Number two, the overall profit factors and success ratio has been about 60% or so. That's good. You want over 50%. It's got a couple of different ratios I can share with you, but you're getting the drift right now. One of the things that's really interesting is that when you look at the historical annual returns each and every year, well, on a gross basis, before fees and before commissions and before all that stuff, if you want to add all that back in, it's only been one time in the last 20 years that it's been down. If you add back in, there's been three times. It's been 2 years about down 1% and 1 year down 13%. In fact, if you look at the years, let's say 2008, it was up a chunk, which the markets really didn't do well. 2009, it was up a chunk. I think it was only 1 year back in the early 90s that it was took a loss. The big run really happened starting back in about 2007. It was slowly progressing higher. If you start out with $10,000 back in 1995, if you reinvested and you follow the strategy exactly, net of all fees, it's worth about $310,000 right now. So this is both short and long. So we opened this up to clients as of right now, or people that want to be involved in this. It's $50,000 minimum investment. We'll have more information on the Disciplined Investor website. The strategy is called AIRO, A-I-R-O, which means it's a Greek word. It means to lift, kind of some strength. And like I said, it goes both sides. It's good for IRAs and non-IRAs as well. But if you want to find out more information about this, because I'm pretty excited about this, actually, you can do so. Just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It will be on the show notes from this particular show, and we'll send you a package on what it's all about, all the stats and charts and things you need to see about it, and what the strategy is all about. And it's really, I think, a pretty good addition to what we are doing right now with the various strategies we have, whether it's the global allocations, the TDIMG, and now we have AIRO. And this is just built, like I said, basically on, or really strictly on technicals. And it's really something that I encourage you to check out the performance and what it's done, and our backtesting and all the history and et cetera. So it is officially open, is officially available. It took a long time to get to this point, but it's here. So that's good news. Okay. The other thing I want to mention is starting this Tuesday at 11 a.m., every other Tuesday, we're going to be actually doing a market update and a live commentary on TradeStation's website. So you can go over there and check it out. It's going to be also, you know, recorded in the history they have there. But if you want to get live commentary on some of the things that are happening, some of the things that are looking good, the week before, the week that's coming up, we're going to do a very nice little session there every other Tuesday, starting this Tuesday at 11 a.m. over at TradeStation. We'll put the link also on the website. So that's something more that you can take a look at. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that, have you been following, again, this whole bird flu issue? Seems to be the time, a season, you know, we see it every year. There's been some more H1N1 and a few other types of outbreaks, at least sightings of the bird flu that's coming in. And last year, about this time, maybe a little bit later into the season, I mentioned a few different stocks. SVA is one of them, and BCRX, BioCryst. I got to tell you something. BioCryst did a lot more than I anticipated. BioCryst, when we talked about it, was about $3 a share. It's now about $12 a share. Now, one of the reasons is obviously because of the interest in the whole bird flu and the possibility of having some kind of a drug that will cure that. But the other thing that's also interesting is if you've been watching the biotechs, they have been just absolutely on fire. I talked about this as one of the areas that may be seeing a lot of benefit into 2014. And man, I got to tell you, between the end of 2013 and the beginning of 2014, the biotechs have been continuing to really show some incredible resilience. And it's also, if you think about the whole healthcare area, but specifically biotechs and new development with an aging population here and abroad, and add to that the fact that there may be some people looking to take some profits on more of the traditional types of investments, one of the things that people do know is that people are getting older, people get sick, and there's a need for many various treatments for all these things. So what happens is if you see a soft market, a lot of times people will gravitate towards those things that are a known outcome. Now, whether or not these companies actually have the ability to get their particular drug through FDA approval and if it is effective is a whole nother discussion. But generally speaking, you'll find that the sentiment and the amount of speculation that will go on with biotechs in a time where other things aren't doing so well may be very good. So I would tell you to think about maybe an ETF, a mutual fund, or even looking at some of these other plays in the biotech area, like I mentioned, Biogen. We have BCRX, you have SVA, which are more specialized. You have Gilead, you have Myriad Genetics. You know, there's a lot of different companies out there that possibly have the opportunity to do very well in an environment that there is a lot of weakness or softness in other areas. So consider that. Also, I wanted to bring up a couple other things here that I thought were really interesting, and the things that have been going on. One of the things that we're also seeing recently is, you know, a lot of concern about China. Now, China's flash index came in, their manufacturing index came in below 50, the first time in about 6 months that they saw a slowdown below the 50 number, which is the demarcation point for either expansion or contraction of an economy. Now, we'll see how that plays out when the quote-unquote official numbers come in, but we're already seeing that the GDP has been slowing down and there's been some other things that have been showing signs of concern in China. One of the big things is, obviously, that the reference rate on the yuan has been increasing, and that is not really good for exports. But one of the other things that you're finding is that there's a lot more scrutiny that is being put on many of these companies due to the fact that the, you know, fraud factor in terms of companies that trade in the U.S. that are Chinese, like a Baidu, Dangdang, you can name a lot of them, has been really becoming more of a concern. And when we looked at the stocks that are traded in the U.S. and on the NYSE or whatever it may be, recently, we saw that they fell to about a two-month low recently, and that was due to the fact that companies like Dangdang and Baidu and some of these other ones are having some question about whether the regulators are going to bar the accounting firms from doing audits of them in their local area. For example, we've been finding that there is some issues right now, and the regulators are finding that, hey, you know what, we don't want you to go and do this because maybe these accounting firms, China units, are not complying with the SEC's, you know, regulations. And in fact, orders to comply for documents and other things have really been met with a lot of resistance. And there's a real concern that if they can't get these documents and they don't get these in for whatever reason, that the companies may be delisted. And that puts you in a bad situation. So watch these stocks, you know, whether it's a SoFun or it's a Sina or a Baidu. All these companies have some exposure to this issue. And if they don't clean themselves up and don't clean this issue up right now and the auditors don't get on it, you may see some further weakness here. And it's unfortunate because many of these companies are excellent companies. And you look at a Baidu, which is just a terrific search engine company, and it's technically the Google of Asia, or really of China. And you look at SoFun, which has some questions, but it's like the Zillow of Asia. You have just a whole host of companies that could come under a lot of scrutiny, and more so, if not scrutiny, it may really spook investors with the idea that they're going to be having the potential of being delisted, and then investors would be, you know, kind of wondering, what do I do from there? So they'd rather get out of the stock than be in it for a long period of time waiting for the unknown. It also may create great opportunities. If you see some of these stocks that are really falling off a cliff because of this, but yet you know maybe that the company is solid and they're just going to have to switch their auditing practices, or they may in fact not have any problems with their auditing and supplying of documents, then you know what? All this excess sell-off is really a great buying opportunity for some of these. So you probably have to look at defining which ones those are. You know, I'd say like the Sinas, the Baidus are probably, you know, going to be better names. Maybe have some questions on some of the other smaller names out there. And especially when you have many of these newsletters that are, you know, that do these hatchet jobs on companies coming out and saying, you know, hey, you know, like Citroen comes, this one's a fraud and they don't have this or that. Because we did have fraud historically, and that didn't end well with like a Sinopharis that, you know, cost billions of dollars to investors. And you still have that concern in the air that that kind of situation could reoccur. So I'd put those on your watch list, many of those names, and I would keep on watching where that all plays out. And if in fact some of this cloud is cleared a bit, that you may have a great opportunity there. The other thing I'll finish this off with is the big issue of Herbalife and Nu Skin and some of the other companies that are in the crosshairs of regulators or even Congress or players that are looking to say that, hey, these are not anything more than pyramid schemes. These deals do not qualify for, you know, anything more than that, and they really should be shut down. We know that there's a major losing bet that's going on right now with Ackman on Herbalife, and you got a couple different sides of this. You got Icon on one side saying, hey, great company, but yet we saw Nu Skin come under scrutiny, and we saw by Chinese regulators, and that's going to now expand probably. Nu Skin dropped about 30-35% on that. And then Herbalife is going to be just in the crosshairs because it's a name that just follows along with that. So those two companies, Nu Skin, N-U-S, and Herbalife, which is H-L-F, is the symbol. It's another two that I put on my watch list. Herbalife has not fallen off as far yet because there's still a lot of good feeling after Icon invested in it. And we had a lot of the company doing a lot of lobbying to really bring back the idea that this is just a bunch of phooey that Ackman's bringing up after his 300-page best idea that went awry on him in the wrong direction. But I would look at those and keep those also on a watch list. All right? Well, that's going to wrap it up for today. Again, I apologize for last week. Make sure you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, get your information on the Arrow strategy, and we'll send you that package. Make sure to be there next Tuesday at 11 a.m. over at tradestation.com, where we're going to be doing the market update and some other information on ETFs and stocks. And other than that, I'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company. a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.